Questions for Professor Lana?
Hi, Angela Bulla from ASEAN. So I have a couple of questions. First, you said that the form factor has no dependence on Q square.
Yes.
And is this like some physical intuition for this? Or?
This is here, yes.
Yes.
I'm sorry, what was the question?
Like, would we expect this to happen? Is this some is there some physical intuition why we don't have any dependence on the Q square?
So I'm not sure I quite get the meaning, but certainly these are the first data on trying to measure these form factors, which is the unknown stuff in these collisions. And while nothing prevents them from depending on x and the momentum transfer, the Q squared. It just turned out with the first measurement that it didn't. It looks fairly flat. But in fact, it does depend on Q squared. If you do better measurements here, and every curve is for a different value of x as a function of Q squared. So for x values of 10 to the the minus signs drop out and the exponents. 10 to the minus 2, it's fairly flat. Right, but at 10 to the minus 6, it really does depend on Q squared. So high up there. And so if you look a bit more closer, better data, it's not quite scale invariant, but there's mild violations of it. And that's due to QCD effects, higher order QCD effects. Does that answer the question?
Yes, okay. And also you mentioned the factorization scale at some point.
Yes.
Mu f. What is this exactly?
Good question. Where should I... Let me first show you this as a way of showing you roughly mathematically what happens. When you write something as a product of two things, in this case, you can actually have a parameter that indicates the ambiguity. For if you look at this, these two factors here, each is a series in the coupling, ER. And it turns out that in many cases, the first order, and only write the logarithm, there's more terms, has a log of mu over Q. And this one has a log of lambda over mu. If you multiply this out at order e squared, you get log of lambda over mu plus log of mu over q squared, and the mu drops out. So, and the same thing happens to higher orders. It's a bit more involved, but so mu is a sort of scale that parameterizes the ambiguity of the factorization. It tells you there is such an ambiguity, and you better make it explicit. So in this case, it is the renormalization scale. But the mu f that you ask about is when you write a cross-section in terms of, there it was, in terms of a parton distribution, the sigma hat. Oh, I have this thing here. Right, let's use it as long as I have it. Here. This is the partonic cross-section. Which has this mu renormalization scale, times these parton distribution functions. And this fact, the fact that you write this as factors, these phis times sigma hat, also has its own ambiguity. And that's what the mu f symbolizes. Right, so you do it inside sigma hat here, you get a mu r. But when you write the whole thing as phi times sigma hat, you have mu f as a scale that parameterizes the ambiguity. Does that make some sense?
Yes, and so the two scales, are they independent? Or?
They are in principle independent, yes. But in almost all cases, do people choose them equal? Mm. So that you don't vary them independently, but you just keep them together and vary them then. That's what most people do. It's a reasonable estimate of the uncertainty in the calculation. There is also a more fundamental meaning to this mu f, which I explained in... as the this scale, so here I just call it mu, but this is the same mu. Right? This is the factorization scale that also governs the scale dependence of these parton distributions. This is the Altarelli-Parisi equation. So it really tells you if I want to evaluate these parton distribution functions at a different scale than where I measure them, I just solve this equation, which is not very hard, and then you know, and then that, that does it for you. Yeah.
Okay. And another question. There was a remark that the gluon and the light. Yes, but the term and the bottom distribution functions can be computed from the gluon ones.
The bottom can be computed from the gluon ones.
Yeah.
Did I say that? It's true, but I don't remember saying it. But it's.
there was a remark somewhere.
That could be. So I can say it in words what I mean, what I meant by that. Indeed, so if you think of a proton, you think of up and down quarks and a gluon, perhaps. So why do we talk about the charm density in the proton and the bottom quark density in the proton? It doesn't make sense. Right? They're heavier than the proton, for Christ's sakes. But you think of it differently. You think of this fast-flying proton, and inside is a sort of collinear flying quarks and gluons. Now, such a gluon can split temporarily into a charm-anti-charm pair as a vacuum fluctuation. And it could be that right in the middle, while it's fluctuating, that fluctuation gets hit by an exchange photon from the other quark. So from that point of view, that quark doesn't see the gluon that initially, but it sees a quark inside the proton. Mm-hmm. Right. Sorry, it sees a charm quark inside the proton. So that's the quantum, it's a quantum process. And it also tells you that you can actually compute the charm density in the proton and the bottom density basically from the other ones.
Okay.
Sort of, I think if you get that idea, I think it's already,
yeah.
I mean, when we get beyond that idea, the technicalities become fierce, the acronyms become long, people talk about variable flavor number schemes, zero mass variable flavor, but that's the basic idea.
Okay, thank you.
Luigi, so I always wondered about this. So you mentioned along the lines that one can say something about, I mean, one can, in theory, from first principle, say something about these PDFs. But I've always been curious about how far can one go with that? I mean, does it make any sense to completely deduce PDFs from first principle? Is it technically impossible? I mean, what's the problem with that? Can you elaborate?
It's not really my expertise. But that's, as I said, it's a real specialized groups. So the way you usually do PDFs is you measure them at a certain scale, where you know them well, where you measure them well, get a good fit with a small error, and then you can always transport them to another value mu using the Altoretic Ries equation. So that first initial condition, that's the non-perturbative bit. Right? That just comes straight from the data. You cannot compute it from first principle. The way you could compute it from first principle is on the lattice. Right? You could define the operator I showed you here, this one. You could try to define this particular operator, which is a non-local operator, on the lattice, which anyway is a difficult thing to do, and then evaluate it in a proton state, take the Fourier transform. It requires, as far as I understand, a large lattice with also these are time-like separated, which is another difficult thing on the lattice. So it's possible groups are doing it actually, and I think they're making progress. I don't think they've replaced yet the old method for the professional groups. They say, well, we follow it, it's interesting, continue, great, but for the moment we still use the old method.
Okay,
but it's something one should continue to do.
Thanks.
Because then you would have a complete up initio calculation.
Then I have another short, very naive question. How does one control experimentally the x, so the fraction of momentum carried by the parton?
You don't.
Right, okay.
So
this was my conclusion.
So that's why the... The only time you do it is I better do this. It looks a bit like you do in lowest order. Where were we? In the parton model. Here. So this Bjorken x is just a function of the external momenta. That you can determine what x is.
Yeah.
And here in the parton model, it's a delta function. So here you control it. But once you go at higher orders, it's always an integral over the size, which you don't control, but they are bounded by the kinematics of the experiment.
Right.
So, for example, if you have, if you want to make in a proton-proton collision something very, very heavy, the part of momentum fractions must be large. You can't do it with only small fractions.
Makes sense.
So that's the way you can limit them, but you cannot select them.
Makes sense. So actually, each experimental point, if you want, in a, on a PDF, are some sort of an average over a small
interval. That's right. It's all distributions.
Okay.
All distributions with a peak roughly around where you want them.
Thanks.
Hey, I'm Gábor Balassa from the Wigner Institute. So you were talking about parton distribution function, but those were just single parton distribution functions, right? So is there a possibility to measure double parton distribution functions? Because it could be important, in, for example, in tetrapark production. Or
yes, actually, you, I think you have telepathic powers. There was a slide which I did not include in my presentation. Let me see if I still have it suppressed. And no, I think I deleted it. So indeed, this is becoming an interesting research program at the LHC, because you collide these protons, and it is, does happen sometimes that not one parton out of every proton collides, but two. Hmm. Now, the probability of that is always a lot smaller. It's just more unlikely to find two partons in a reasonable range of momentum fractions. But it does happen. And then the question becomes, first of all, can you distinguish it from the back? Can you distinguish it from the single collisions? And there you use experimental tricks, like you, for example, look for two W's produced, but the same charge, so W plus W plus. That would, you can make that also with single parton, but then the diagram becomes much more complicated and smaller, with higher orders. Whereas with, if you have two partons coming in, with two partons hitting them, each single process is simple. You just make it W plus. So that's a way of selecting the two-parton production, of the two-parton collisions over one-parton collisions. And then you must, if you then identify this, and it's just been measured by CMS for the first time with six sigma away from zero, so it's a real discovery. How do you describe it? So what I just said was a picture of taking the parton model squared. Just use one collision, take the square. There's a formula for it. It's called the pocketbook formula, where you just use the single collision formula twice and divide by some constant number. If you want to be more professional about it at some point, you must define something like the two-parton density. And indeed, people are looking at that already. They have defined these matrix elements. It's just a lot harder to get data for that, because there's always the one-parton collisions in front. And how to remove that and get really a two-parton collision data, really tough.
Yes, okay. Thank you.
Yeah, this is Burns. It's a related question, but there are these like forward programs at the LHC, right, where you look at the projectile of the interaction, and what is the relation of the PDF to that? Like, here, I guess the assumption is that it's frozen, but the fact that they get the recoil, does anything interesting happen?
Well, in principle, it's actually very interesting. I mean, a less forward but very interesting experiment is LHCb in that regard. So if you want to look at, and LHCb data now also coming into parton distribution function, because if you then have a collision where something is produced very forward, that means that one of the two partons had a very small momentum fraction. So you come in a very small momentum fraction, very large momentum fraction, the result will go very forward. So that's a way to test the partons at very small momentum fractions. Right? That's a very nice way of actually selecting that very small momentum fraction region. So even more forward, experiments can help with that too, because it's very hard to get other data there that are useful. So yeah, they're very useful.
I wasn't asking about the, what is it, the, let's say, the parton coming out essentially, but the rest of the proton that flies away.
Oh, the remainder.
And
what is your question about that?
How, like, the assumption in the PDF, I think it's that it's like a frozen time inside the disk. But the fact that it gets a recoil means that there is a little bit of thing happening, and you can imagine
that's
that part of flying, there is something happening. Is
that's
there
right.
anything interesting?
It's a different so what I'm looking at is, and that story I gave, it's the point of view of the colliding parton or electron. At the moment of collision, that short time frame, that's what it sees. then the afterwards, there is a plenty of time for that proton to develop and do things, but just at the time, the short time that the electron has to pass to go through that proton is so short, that's when you can really make those relativistic assumptions. But at long time scales, when the thing has flown on and broken up, that is so much more longer, then you cannot maintain that useful picture anymore. Anyway, it's garbage by then, right, for us. And it goes off and it's no longer interesting. It just causes damage and, yeah.
Talking about, sorry, cuckoo here.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah, sorry. Cortus altus, yeah. The PDFs are going to be measured, I think, directly if this machine, the E-RIC machine, comes on, right? Is that not the case?
The data from E-RIC will contribute, no doubt, to better determinations of parton distribution functions. My understanding is that particularly if you want to have the parton model for nuclei, so then that's really when E-RIC of EIC becomes quite useful. For the proton, probably as well, but I don't know to what extent. But particularly for treating the whole nucleus as a big proton with lots of particles inside.
Hi, Anna Maria Lemieux. So, during your presentation, you've emphasized a lot about the precision.
Yes.
So I was curious, to what power of n in NLO would you like to go, and do you need to go?
That's a good, very good question. I'll address that. I mean, the sheep answer, I'll talk about that tomorrow.
Okay.
But I'll give you a preview. So the answer is, in principle, as high as possible, but there is an optimum in terms of what precision do you need and how much effort is it, as you also suggest, right? So. But that is not always sociologically or psychologically how people work. I mean, the group of people is a large group that focuses on these higher order methods. They're so fascinated by that alone, they just go to one order more than they really need to, just because you can. And but the need is great, because some reactions, Grelian, for example, is already measured at a per mil accuracy. And that's very, very small. So at that accuracy, at experimental level, lots of tiny details start coming in at the theoretical level as well. So then you really need to go to at least NLO. For Higgs is already, N cubed LO is already reached. Then you want to generalize that to more distributions. And so everything needs upgraded. And the upgrading gets ever harder, because the more precise you get, the more smaller effects come again. And you need to control all of those. So. An interesting thing, but this is going in the same direction as the G-2 experiments. They have fantastic precision. You need to control a lot of stuff, and that's the same, well, similar at LHC. So what you need to do and what you want to do, they're not always quite the same, but pretty much you want to go as high as you can. Anyway, at some point, the computers run out, your energy runs out. The time scales are too long for people to getting jobs. It's all that, and so all these things coming in.
Thank you.
And just a remark: the one over n expansion will also be divergent, and that depends on n itself. So
the one over n expansion.
The one over n expansion.
That could be, well, you would know.
Yeah,
right? So
yeah,
the.
So.
But the one of n expansion in these perturbative QCD is not used much.
Sorry?
The one of n expansion in perturbative QCD is not used much.
No, no.
Only to organize the calculation in some sense. Well, that's the other thing is, that's maybe another answer to your question, which I don't talk about, is we computed a perturbation theory, and we assume it's a convergent series. But it's not. These are all divergent series. These are all asymptotic series. And asymptotic series, if you don't know, they do get smaller and smaller up to a point, and then they get larger and larger again. So there's always an intrinsic uncertainty to that, but we haven't reached that yet, not even close. But that's something to keep in mind, that there are almost no convergent series in perturbative quantum field theory, four-dimensional quantum field theory. Yeah.
One last question. Could you go maybe to slide 39? 39? 39, yeah. Where is this plot with the cross section and the momentum?
This one? Oh, this one?
Yes. Why is it at a low PT that we get such a difference between the curves?
It's a very interesting question, actually, and it really illustrates a fun. I'll address this tomorrow, but there's value in repetition, so I'll say it now. So the blue curve is the fixed order, the NLO. So I don't have a blackboard here, but imagine and what it indicates is, so at the left-hand side of the plot, the transverse momentum of the top anti-top pair is very, very small there. Now, how does it get that transverse momentum, that pair? At lowest order, you have this quark anti-quark coming in and a top anti-top going out. The pair has no transverse momentum. And when you add up the four momenta of the top anti-top, you get no transverse momentum. It's just because it's momentum conservation. At next order, you can have one gluon emission. And the PT of that gluon is precisely minus the PT of that pair. Right, so it gets the top anti-top pair gets the transverse momentum from the recoil against the soft gluon. Right. Now imagine that soft gluon, if the gluon radiates off a leg and there's a propagator afterwards. If the gluon is very soft, that propagator behaves like 1/0 almost. That's why this thing blows up. Right, this is not physics, this is just the artifact of being in finite order. This is just a propagator blowing up because the transverse momentum of the extra gluon is so small, so soft, that the pair has a very, very low recoil against it. On the other hand, the all-order behavior is like this, very different, and in fact, it's what the data do. So that's a bit of a different effect. So this is called Sudakov suppression, and it has a nice physical interpretation. Sudakov suppression in a formula looks like e to the minus logarithm squared. So if the log gets large, e to the minus logarithm squared is very small. Now, why does that become very small? Well, you're dealing with a situation where you collide two partons with color charges. It's a violent process. And you know, so you have these charges that are accelerating or decelerating violently. And they love to radiate then. You know, accelerating charges radiate. That's what happens. So you have a pretty violent process. So radiation should be very easy, happens very naturally. But what you're asking here is that the radiation that happens almost is not there. You're asking the probability here for a top anti-top being produced in a violent process with almost no extra radiation being produced. That's not what physics wants. It's very, very unlikely. It happens, but it's very unlikely. That's why the curve goes down. So it is the unlikeliness of radiation of having almost no radiation. It's a double negative. The unlikeliness of having almost no radiation. Yeah. So this is called Sudakov suppression, and that indeed what the data show and what resummation shows.
Thank you.
Any more questions? Berens?
Yes, so as a generic setting, so when say a quark is scattered off from the original proton, then because the quark carries away color charge, the remnant would be color charged as well, right? And what happens? There's a gluon, long distance gluon exchange, or what happens?
Well, color is not like a charge that sums linearly up to zero or not. Right? This is a non-abelian charge. You can have the color accounting for color is more complicated. But one could imagine, for example, that the quark flies out. There's a vacuum bubble nearby that happens to be there and has also of its two components has a color charge that some of them combine, and you get a whole shower of partons, each with different colors, and they can combine to zero in different ways. So keeping track of color as the system evolves far to the detector is very complicated to do, and to really do a bit by bit accounting for that. The same thing when the remnant of the proton that can be that splits into various partons and rearranges the color. There's a lot of freedom there, so it's not a useful tool to see what's going on, at least not completely.
Yes? Dieter. Height is the name.
Isn't there a problem with the momentum sum rule, since you have to perform the integral over a range which is not measured?
Well, you don't measure, but you do have a, the PDFs are defined for the full range. So the data constrain the form of the PDF to some extent, but of course where you don't measure it, the uncertainty will be large. But there is some information there. But the constraint on the momentum sum rule is absolute. You cannot have the momentum sum rule with an error. Right? So the solution, the fit of the PDFs must happen under the constraint that the momentum sum rule is fully satisfied.
But at x values below, let's say 10 to the minus 6, you don't know whether the theory is working. You have to make the assumption, first of all, the extrapolation, and then the validity over that range.
Yeah, you do assume, and there are good reasons for that, that you can extend the theory to very small x values for the PDFs. Mm. Right, that's so the momentum sum rule cannot be violated, otherwise you really have trouble with the whole setup. Right, yeah. Same with charge, right? You cannot violate the charge sum rule. So you have various parameterizations for these functions, but they do have some constraints. Momentum sum rule and the charge sum rule must always be satisfied in this framework.
Thank you.
More questions? Yes. Anna Maria Hell. Go ahead.
So, when you listed the Feynman diagrams for QCD, why didn't you list also the four vertex?
The what? The what?
The four gluon vertex.
Oh.
You had the cubic one, but you did not have the four.
Out of laziness, but it's there. You're right.
So you just did not fit into the slide.
Where was it? Here. Well, yeah, you can sort of see where they come from. Here is the G mu nu.
Yeah.
And here is the square of G mu nu with the Lagrangian.
And you have the cubic.
So you see,
one.
Indeed, you do get this term squared. So it is there. It is, however, order G squared. So it's one order higher in
yes.
coupling.
Yes.
But if you work to that order, you should include it. Absolutely, and we do.
Yeah, I was just curious why it was not on the transparent.
Well, there's more terms missing. If you're that sharp to see that that is missing, what else is missing here? When you really want to use it for perturbation theory. So it's nothing wrong with it, but if you want to use it for perturbation theory, something else is missing.
Ah, okay.
Or maybe someone else. Hmm? Yes, you also get it, but yeah. I don't refer to the counter terms, but that's also missing, yeah. So don't make it sound too bad, like a gauge fixing, indeed. So you need, because from this Lagrangian, you need to define the propagators. And you can only do that, it's no problem for the fermions, but for these you can only do it once you've chosen a gauge. And certainly covariant gauges, then you also need to introduce ghosts, etc. So that those terms you would use, and then you have the full set of Feynman rules with which you can really start going to work. Yeah. And then the counter terms to make it finite, that's true. Counter terms, which finite corrections if that are up to you.
Associated with the ghost.
Sorry?
Associated with the ghost.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah,
yeah.
Sure.
Yeah. And then after that, the Lagrangian is no longer invariant under local symmetries, but it is invariant under BRST symmetry. That's sort of that was a great discovery. Yes, sorry.
Hello. Can you use, for example, lattice QCD calculations to have some information about these parton distribution functions? I don't know.
Yes, so people are working on that. It is not an easy thing. Because the operator, so when you define, when you evaluate an operator on the lattice, I'm not the lattice expert at all, so, but from what I understand, these are not easy operators to evaluate on the lattice. They do manage by various methods, but with large uncertainties. At the moment, that is not yet competitive with using data as input, but certainly the hope is, and otherwise they wouldn't work on it, that eventually this will be useful and maybe even the main step, but it's a bit of a distance still. People work on it.
Yes, anybody else? If not, we thank the speaker.
Thank you for your questions.
Okay.